You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome, welcome everybody, as always, to our FOMC panel, this time for March. There's a lot that has been going on and a lot of recent data that I want to talk about with our lovely panelists today. Those of you who have attended our panels know that I like to keep these things wide open for discussion. So anything you'd like to add to a prior speaker's point, anything you'd like to disagree with, please feel free to jump right in. The only request I have is we leave microphones muted until the prior speaker is completely done talking, so we don't get that overlap and feedback for the folks today. So to start us off, I'm going to run through our panelists. As always, we've got the Fed guy himself, Joseph Wang. As many of you may know, he headed trading at the Fed's open markets desk and has a great introductory book that I cannot recommend enough on central banking called Central Banking 101. Welcome back, Joseph. A lot to talk about today.
Hey, Nicholas. Hey, Unusual Wells. Hey, everyone on the panel. Thanks so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. And yes, what an exciting time to be in markets. I look forward to our discussion.
As do I. Next, we've got another frequent face to the panels, Last Bear Standing, an expert on markets, and he writes about monetary policy as well as different sectors in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to that, folks, go do that. Lots of alpha coming out of the Last Bear Standing. Welcome back, Last Bear.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. We have an interesting day and an interesting time in the markets over the past couple of weeks, so I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Next, we've got Bob Elliott back after what seems like forever, the CIO at Unlimited Funds, former IC at Bridgewater, and the PM of HFND. He brings vast knowledge and non-reactionary takes, which is a really big breath of fresh air in these times. Welcome back, Bob. How you doing?
Thanks so much for having me. I was stuck at an institutional investment conference last Fed meeting, where I seemed I was the only person paying attention to the Fed. So it's nice to get together with a group that seems to be a little more timely in their thinking about markets. So good to see everybody. Thanks for having me.
Fair enough, Bob. Thanks for coming back. And I mean, this time, man, you're just trapped with us. So you're just stuck in a ever-ending cycle. Next, we've got Marco Begovic. Love having him here as well, the founder and CEO of Arcomino Research, where he provides in-depth research on U.S. macroeconomics and the markets as a whole. Marco has nearly two decades of experience working in the markets as an equity broker, investment advisor, manager, even as chief bank macroeconomist, and his forecasts and analysis help educate and inform investors around the world. Love having you here, Marco. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here again.
And a pleasure to have you and all of you. So a little bit of a quick macro overview since we last got together for FOMC. In February, the CPI increased by 0.2% on a seasonally adjusted basis. over the last 12 months, all items index rose by 2.8%, a slight decrease from the 3% increase observed in January. Also in February, for total non-FAR payroll employment, there was an increase of 151,000, slightly below the average monthly gain of 168,000 over the prior 12 months. Tariff talks, of course, and their concerns have maintained frequency in the headlines, with the markets kind of teetering to and fro with the volatility that comes with them. FedWatch now places the odds of a rate cut pretty dang low, with 98% chance of holding the current rates. All the while, gold has been on an absolute tear, as we've all seen, setting new all-time highs more than once this year already. So, deep breath to start us off here right out of the gate. Joseph, with that February CPI report showing a year-over-year inflation rate of 2.8%, which is down from 3% in January, is this decline evidence that the Fed's inflation fight is largely over? Should we remain in an area of caution here?
Well, first off, that's a really great summary. So I think to look at where the Fed is, we should take a step back. Now, the Fed looks at CPI, looks at PPI, but most importantly, it looks at PCE. Now, the month-over-month prints for inflation have been a bit volatile over the past few months. In January, we got kind of a scare that month-over-month was a bit higher than expected, probably due to seasonality. But like you mentioned, in February, it came down, and that gave a bit more confidence that we are on a disinflationary path. But bigger picture, though, whereas year-over-year basis, PCE is just a little bit above the Fed's target, say about 2.6%. It's kind of been stuck there over the past few months. It is drifting lower, but very slowly. So the Fed is not yet on target, but getting there slowly. But there's something new that's happened over the past few weeks is, as you alluded to, the tariff wars. And that seems to be having a really big impact on inflation expectations for part of the public. And with inflation a little bit above target, inflation expectations, especially for some parts of the political spectrum going out of control, it doesn't seem like the Fed is ready to call victory on the inflation fight now. However, on the other front, it does seem like this tariff talk is chilling investments, and we do see maybe some signs of slowing of the economy. So they're heading towards a place where there's a lot more uncertainty. And my guess is, based on what Chair Powell is saying, they're just going to be watching and seeing, kind of frozen in place, seeing how all these policy changes shake out before they make a move, basically committing to be late, whatever the outcome is.
Well, I think from that, I think what folks have pointed out so far in terms of the pressures on the FOMC is right. I think what's interesting is that the policy mix that we're seeing, particularly out of the federal government over the course of, you know, so far and likely to happen in the next couple of quarters, is going to further constrain Chairman Powell's ability to do much, partially because the tariffs are inflationary. It'll take a little while for that to show up, but I think the Fed at least is recognizing that if tariffs get implemented, it will be inflationary ahead, and so we'll be cautious to ease in that context. And also because the significant curtailment of immigration has created a meaningful reduction in labor supply. And so we could easily see a circumstance where GDP growth, like real GDP growth, is falling or slowing, is maybe the best way to say it, from, you know, the strength that we saw the last couple of years. But the unemployment rate isn't meaningfully shifting because labor supply is so constrained from the combination of reduced immigration and continued retirements from the baby boomers. And so if that's the case, basically Chairman Powell's going to face a set of circumstances where, you know, the unemployment rate is not going to be moving up sufficiently to support meaningful cuts, and where the inflationary pressures will make them cautious to be proactive. And so you put those two things together, and it's basically like, you know, they're going to do nothing. You know, they're going to eat their lunch and have nice conversations and do nothing for us. And that's, I guess it would be pretty easy to be a central banker doing nothing over the next 3, 6, 9 months.
Tell them to rope me into that doing nothing camp too, Bob. Joseph, I'd love your take there as well. Do you have any comments to Bob's feedback there?
Well, first off, I agree with Marco that unemployment is the thing to watch right now. I think one of the things that we've noticed over the past few years is that this Fed places a higher premium on unemployment than inflation. That's probably part of the reason why we've had above target inflation for such a long time. Now, the unemployment rate dropped to 4.1%, as Marco noted. And so, strangely, even though we triggered the SOM rule, whereas the unemployment rate usually exhibits upward momentum, when it goes up, it usually continues to go up. There was kind of a freak out last year when we were at 4.3%. It kind of went back down to 4.1%. And part of that could be, as Bob mentioned, we have these underlying demographic shifts where labor supply was growing by millions and millions during the Biden administration. Now it's not growing to the same extent. At the same time, though, we also have all these changes on the fiscal side. So Chair Powell mentioned that we have big changes on trade, on regulatory side, on the fiscal side as well. So if we do have these big cuts by DOGE, and it's hard to know how impactful they are because, you know, DOGE posts these things, but you have all these other people who say differently. But there's a big ecosystem that feeds off of these grants in the federal government. There's a good piece by Anna Wong that flags that even though the overall federal employees in the U.S. is only 2 million, it's been 2 million for decades. That's because the way the federal government grows right now is that it hires all these contractors and pays for them through you know, grants and other kinds of spending. And so as...
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
DOGE works. You could see that lower, so lower jobs by the federal government, but also all these contractors maybe not having work anymore. And so there's a difficult dynamic where, again, austerity, fiscal policy also changes in immigration policy. So labor market is definitely to watch, hard to know what to do. And like Bob mentioned, and as Chair Powell has said, he's just going to kind of sit and look at the data rather than act proactively. Although some people on the Fed, as we learned last time, are working in some of these policy changes into their forecast, there's going to be so much uncertainty, it's hard to see those forecasts being in use. So yeah, Bob is right. Central bankers are just going to have to wait and see what happens. Again, that just commits them to being, they're over-tightening probably, in my view, because that data is going to take some time to show up.
Thank you, Joseph. So I want to touch a little bit here before I kick us back to the topic of GDP, the topic of employment, wage growth, et cetera, has come up a few times now already here at the top. So I want to tackle that. So like we mentioned earlier, total non-farm payrolls increased by a little bit less than expected, which may not stand out much. But on the other hand, 100 tech companies across the world have terminated nearly 30,000 jobs during the first 3 months of 2025 so far, per Rational FX. The technology sector of America specifically really contributed to that, cutting its workforce by 20,000, while the Trump administration has significantly downsized federal employment amidst pushback from other politicians. So I want to start us off with Last Bear here and kick this one around the panel. Is this a precursor to more unemployment moving into the rest of the year? And how will job cuts, if at all, affect Fed policy?
Well, on the last point, I think it's pretty clear that if we start to see, I think Joseph mentioned it before, but the Fed definitely looks at employment. Certainly over the past couple of years have prioritized employment over inflation. Maybe they're swinging back a little bit on that pendulum to some degree, given that they've been over target for a couple of years at this point. But generally speaking, I think it's true to say that if the labor market goes, the Fed's going to step in to support it in that respect. I would say that we're in a period of a lot of uncertainty. And so as companies are thinking about, you know, how all of these different policy changes might impact their businesses, it obviously disincentivizes investment in the short term, more conservatism around hiring. Obviously, we've seen a lot of data come through in soft data, like the Michigan Sentiment Survey, that shows that people are now much more concerned about losing their job. I do think we need to be at least somewhat cautious about looking at especially soft metrics in the short term, just because of the way that, you know, headlines and sort of the political discussions can sort of influence people's opinions in the short term. Obviously, we see that in the sentiment survey with the, you know, Republicans versus Democrats, how they view different things like inflation and the economy. And I think that there is some aspect of that that's sort of floating out there that's maybe making these softer data look a little bit worse than maybe they are right now. But I do think that just given the context where we have for 2 years now, just consistent slowdown in job openings, you know, decreases in job openings. Generally now we've been gaining jobs at a level that's a little bit lower than what it was over the past decade. It's kind of held at that level relatively flat for the past year or so. But as folks mentioned, we've benefited from a huge amount of influx of labor supply over the past couple of years. That's basically gone down to zero in the past month. And so I do think that we really need to look at this in a new lens, recognizing that the policy, the policy circumstance have changed pretty dramatically, and that companies are going to be cautious. And one thing that what you see happen when things really sort of spiral in a recession, which I'm not sure is exactly going to happen, but we should be aware of it, is that it sort of feeds on itself, right? So as soon as you start to have higher levels of uncertainty, higher levels of pessimism, people getting fired, people spending less, it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. And I think that's a situation where the Fed would absolutely step in on. But it's a risk that we have to look at, you know, from a market perspective today.
Thank you. Last Bear, does anyone have anything to add to that in reference to employment?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I thought it was pretty interesting. And I posted this, was it yesterday or the day before, this, the Michigan expected change in unemployment during the next year, like, was just incredibly weak. And now, of course, the Michigan survey has a variety of different, let's call it partisan issues. But we didn't see, in the same way we saw some of that partisan issue stuff post-2016, we didn't really see that in this particular measure. Around consumers' projections of employment conditions. And it has typically been a pretty good short leading indicator of employment from the households. And so really it raises the question from my perspective of whether, you know, whether there's something something moving quickly under the surface that we're not necessarily, you know, it's going to take a little time to see around employment, or are people picking up on, you know, we're likely to see more significant cuts in the next couple of months. You know, so far it's not really in the hard data related to employment, like initial claims, obviously. But that was a pretty disconcerting piece of information, at least from my perspective, you know, put into the context of how it's been a pretty good indicator over time.
Thank you, Bob. So still on this same vein of conversation, there's also the topic of mass deportations, which obviously has been discussed on most macro panels we've done, at least a little bit. But BlackRock's Fink says that Trump's aggressive deportations will have, quote, a severe impact on agriculture and construction, while many immigrants, both legal and undocumented, fear for what is to come, especially given the fact that on a couple of occasions, American citizens themselves have been caught up in these deportation tactics and have already been deported as well. So my question here is, first, is Fink correct about what may happen to agriculture and construction and the deportation investors as they continue to ramp up? Let's start with Marco on this one and kick her around.
I think the deportation issue is probably more political than actually something that we can really measure in the data. It's like many people talked about it during 2023, 2024, that immigrants were responsible for the labor force going up, but we cannot really know that for sure. Like there is no definitive data that can tell us, okay, this is because of immigrants or this is not because of immigrants. So actually it's more like we can only speculate on this topic. But what we actually know currently is that the participation rate actually went down in February, which is not a good sign. The participation rate is actually now the lowest since December 2022, and this is not really something that happens when you have a strong labor market, when you have an expanding labor market. So actually this is something to watch. The unemployment rate would probably be higher if it wasn't for the participation rate falling in February. Of course it's hard to know by what percentage, but if we would take all the people that are no longer counted as part of the labor force, actually that they were actually unemployed, the unemployment rate would be at 4.4%. So this is like 4.1, 4.4, 4.4 is potentially concerning for the Fed, but for now it doesn't show in the official data. Maybe if the participation rate doesn't go down anymore, or maybe if it goes up, maybe we see some of that some of the unemployment rate going up as a result. But we don't know. We just need to wait for the data to
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Send it.
I think it's worth noting that in the U.S., there are a very, very large number of illegal migrants, you know, 10, 20, 30 million, who knows, especially over the past 2 years, there's border law basically was not enforced. So you had millions of people come in. Now, deporting them logistically is very, very difficult. So what the administration seems to be doing right now is prioritizing those that have criminal records. And so I think that's probably going to be the approach first, you know, deport people who are violent, who you know, are not doing anything, and then work the list from down. But I think to deport, you know, people, all the people here illegally, that's really, really difficult. So I'm not sure if the efforts will be enough so that it really have a big macro impact. The bigger impact, I think, is simply enforcing border law so that the ongoing growth doesn't happen.
Yeah, I just threw in a chart that I posted a couple weeks ago of the amount of what's called at-large detentions, which, long story short, is like a reasonable indication of people that are early in the process of getting deported. And while that's up 600% relative to the previous administration over the first, I think this is the first 30 days, give or take, of the new administration, it's only 20,000 people in a one-month time frame. So, you know, times 12 is, you know, 250,000 people, give or take, which certainly is meaningful to those people, but not from a macroeconomic perspective, at least not yet, at a pace that would have a meaningful macro implication versus the amount of inbound, as Joseph highlighted. It went from running at about 3 million, give or take, during the administration, the previous administration, to essentially zero based upon the most recent data that we have from Southwest border encounters. So that's a much bigger influence than the deportations at this point.
Yeah, I would add, just adding on to that point, you know, if you look at just the southern border encounter data, I think, and only focus on adults, you know, the adult count, not including minors, that's been over the growth and, you know, over the monthly change in payrolls for at least a year and a half. So, and the, you know, you can look at other things like the difference between the household and establishment survey as potentially some evidence for how immigration has, you know, is reflected in the different numbers there. Obviously, there's the foreign-born and national-born series as well, which obviously isn't exclusively relating to the sort of illegal immigration that we're talking about, but maybe picking up some of that as well. So I do think that there are a lot of data points, and, you know, just strategically thinking, I think we understand that there probably was an economic reason, regardless of what people might feel about, you know, the immigration policy of the last administration, where they were, you know, explicitly trying to alleviate a labor shortage at a point when, you know, it was a big problem coming out of COVID. So I do think that it's really, that this point is really important. I agree that deportations is probably a very small part of it, and those involved in deportations may not have been working in the, you know, on the books economy as it is. But the lack of immigration is, or the cutoff of immigration, I think is not to be discounted.
Also, guys, we're going to have all these people come in with $5 million golden visas, man. They're going to be pouring in, so don't worry.
Sorry, that one had to give me a nice little chuckle. Thanks, Joseph. So just to kind of kick us back here toward that topic of GDP, as we mentioned, the recent GDP data shows that 2.3% growth in Q4 of last year. But again, some forecasts suggest a contraction of 2.3% in quarter one of this year. So I'm curious, we only kind of tickled the topic a little bit, but how much weight should we give to early GDP estimates? And do we expect revisions to show a more positive or negative picture? Joseph, could you start us off on this one?
So that negative print from the Atlanta Fed GDP now has been very getting a lot of publicity, but it seems to be skewed largely due to imports, specifically to tremendous amounts of gold imports. And maybe that contributes to the scramble for gold we see in the gold price. So the creator of the Atlanta Fed actually has a post talking about that. And he adjusts for gold imports. And according to his adjustment, the Atlanta Fed, the correct Atlanta Fed GDP now is about 0.4, 0.5%. So it's really low compared to the 3% we've been accustomed to. But I think that's kind of should be expected. Now, I don't know if it's 0.5, but we should be expecting slower growth. As Bob and the last pair have been talking about, we're, you know, less labor force growth, fewer people working. Naturally, the economy is going to be on a slower path. So that seems to make sense. I don't know if it's exactly should be 0.5%, but we shouldn't be seeing the same amount of growth we've seen in the past couple of years.
I think that Joseph is right about this. Regarding GDP, I think that we should actually concentrate on the personal spending and not really on net exports, because even if the overall number ends up negative in the end, it's actually all about what happens with the personal consumption. If a personal consumption only contributes 0.3 percentage points to the GDP, like the Atlanta Fed is actually showing in the GDP now, this will be a significant slowdown from 2.5 or around that in recent quarters. So this is something that we should actually watch. We've seen some of the data, like the retail control group, which is actually it was flat in the first 2 months of the first quarter. So actually, it all depends on what happens in March. Maybe if it comes in flat in March, then we could potentially have a problem, because flattish personal consumption is never a good thing to have, because it can easily tip the other way in the next quarter. So this is something that we should really need to watch. And these net exports, it's more volatile. It's like Joseph said, due to some other stuff and calculations, and we should not really focus on that, because that will probably not give us the right information. But the personal consumption will give us the right information about what will actually going to happen with the GDP over the next few quarters. Because if it, I don't know, if the March magically rebounds and we see, I don't know, some good increase in March, maybe personal consumption can rise by more than 0.3. I mean, maybe it can contribute by more than 0.3 percentage points to the overall GDP, and that would be a good thing. But if we don't see that, then potentially we could have a problem. So this is something that I'm actually focused on.
Thank you, Marco. So still kind of continuing here on that notion of potential economic slowing, some lawmakers are pushing for a fiscal stimulus to offset. Now, data from the Treasury also does show that government spending hasn't slowed under the Trump administration thus far. And in fact, spending during his first month was up roughly $80 billion from the same time frame a year ago. So my question here, I guess, would be, do you think additional government spending would help stabilize growth, or would it risk reigniting inflation? Last bear, and then I'd like to kick this one around the panel too.
Yeah, I think the problem with the budget is obviously more than just what's being discussed in the DOGE type areas. I think that to the extent that they're finding misuse or waste and fraud, I think that's great and hopefully can be eliminated. But the big portions are areas that, you know, they've dedicated and been very clear that they're not looking to touch, and that are much more politically sensitive, like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And obviously, increasingly, the growing interest on the debt itself, which increased, I believe, from about $500 billion a year to now about $1.1 billion just in the past, or $1.1 trillion, sorry. So it's basically doubled in the past two years since rate cuts or since rate hikes started. And the weighted average interest rate on the debt is only, I think, 3.3% right now. So it's lower than where all the current, you know, market prices of U.S. debt trade. And as debt continues to get rolled onto those new rates, that interest increase is going to continue to rise, absent, you know, further cuts from here. And so those aspects of the budget are not being addressed by DOGE, at least currently. And so the big problem with the structural problems, which include worsening demographics, how that will impact Social Security and those sort of entitlement spendings, which again are a majority of the budget, are not getting better either. So like the Social Security Trust Fund is now in decline for the first time ever after the past, you know, year or two. Demographics are going to make that worse. So there's the government spending isn't going to slow as a result of, unless there's much more serious cuts or structural changes here. So I don't think it makes sense. And I don't think that there's a lot of political will to do large scale stimulus at this point. I think that we've done plenty of stimulus over the past 5 years or so. And I'm not sure that that's sort of in the agendas, in the agenda of the current administration right now. And I don't know that it would be a wise decision, especially given that if it was meant to offset tariffs or other administrative changes. Like, those are the policy changes that the administration thinks is best for the country the long term. So it doesn't really make sense to sort of go with what you think is a good policy and then also try to support it with other policy that you don't think is as good long term.
Thank you, Last Bear. So kind of curving us toward the markets and equities a little bit while still maintaining this growth topic. Bob, you recently said of the markets, quote, U.S. growth expectations haven't changed much despite the increasing mix of growth negative policies from the new administration. You kind of went on to say until these expectations shift downward more significantly, buy the dip is more likely a trap rather than a desirable buying opportunity. So, Bob, if you could you break down what you meant by that and whether or not you kind of anticipate more downside to come in equities?
Yeah, I think from a macro perspective, when you think about what drives equity returns, it's really how conditions come in relative to expectations. And we had in 23 and 24 a couple of years where expectations were very depressed. And, the economy did pretty well. And, you know, from a macro perspective, that was an important driver of why stock prices continued to rally. But coming into this year, you know, expectations were very high in terms, much higher, in terms of what was going to happen with the U.S. economy, and actually became almost euphoric after the election. And I think the challenge is, you know, there was some expectation that this would be the most pro-business and pro-growth administration in the post-war era. And so far, the policy mix and really the policy focus has been on a series of, at a minimum, short-term negative growth policies, whether it's restricting immigration, increasing tariffs, or cutting back on federal spending. Now, those policies, I think it's arguable, sort of medium-long-term, whether they create a more productive U.S. economy. We can argue about that point because I think there's more ambiguity there. But in the short term, it's pretty clear that those policies are growth negative, and it's really a question of when are we going to start to see a reset of expectations to weaker economic conditions being priced by, you know, either economists or markets. And so far, we really have not seen much in the way of a shift. You know, stocks are down 10% or something like that. You know, but it's been ahead of that. It was basically the best 2 years of equity market performance in a century. So, you know, it's not like we've really meaningfully reset expectations. And look, usually you want to buy the dip or buy stocks when expectations are very depressed. There's big monetary and fiscal easing, and there's positive economic momentum. And if you look at what's going on right now, it's basically the opposite on all three of those fronts. And so, I think there's a lot of short-term focus. Oh, it's down 10%, so this is, you know, or maybe Mag 7's a little worse. You know, this is I heard from one person that this is a generational buying opportunity. And I look at that and I say, you know, like the types of conditions we saw in March of 2009 were generational buying opportunities. This, if anything, looks like a trap.
Anyone have any agreement or disagreement with Bob?
Yeah, I guess I would say, so I know that my name on here is the Last Bear Standing, but I think people who've at least read my Substack over the years know that I haven't been a perma bear through this time, at least with respect to, you know, where equity prices in the US are going. And I think it's maybe even annoyed some people at points, but I agree with Bob on, I think he makes a great point around expectations. You know, there was for a year or two, 2022, 2023, widespread expectations for a recession, you know, models that, you know, economic models that were saying that it was 90% plus certainty or confidence on that. And then sort of the gradual soft landing narrative became much more of the dominant narrative to the point where now that's been totally accepted. You also have sort of thematic trends in equities that have been really powerful. Obviously, AI kind of stands out at the top of that list. And that's been a real driver for growth. But there's also a huge amount of expectations sort of that are baked in that. And you start to see, you know, semiconductors, I think, peaked maybe 6 months or 9 months ago. If you look at the broad index, obviously, we've seen less enthusiasm in those sort of areas. And I think that you also saw, especially post-election, a lot of the euphoric type activity that was just super, super reminiscent of sort of 2021. In some cases, it was literally the same names or coins or whatever involved, where you have sort of the just sort of blow off top that I think is important to recognize just from like where we are in the sentiment cycle. And so I do think we came from a trough, especially you could maybe argue that the Silicon Valley Bank collapse and takeover bailout was sort of the bottom of 2022, 2023 sort of sell off. That things have generally been improving from an expectations perspective since then. And I think now you see the market much more seriously consider, the political uncertainty, the ongoing weakening in the macro environment that we've talked about with respect to growth and employment. And, you know, things are priced for perfection. So I think that there is continued downside on this. I think from a technical perspective, you see, this drawdown maybe is not that unusual in terms of its total size, but if you look at just sort of broader momentum indications like 200-day moving average or those sort of things, we've kind of been stalling out on growth in the equity market for the past couple months. The equal weighted index has down. I think that peaked in early December. So you start to see this weakening in technicals, concern about legitimate concerns around the macroeconomic environment, and you have prices that are sort of looking at a blue sky scenario. So I think it's a challenging environment.
Thank you, Last Bear. So kind of in addition to this, we tickled the topic a little bit of gold. So in addition to kind of the volatility we've seen in equities, the gold situation has seen borderline euphoric at times, with cracking all-time highs here in early 25 more than once. Is this apparent gold rush a form of foreshadowing for equity fears at all? Marco, what do you think?
Well, actually, I think that gold is actually trying to predict what is actually going to happen with the economy. If the economy starts to deteriorate, the Fed will most likely cut rates and probably initiate another form of liquidity expansion. So this is something that gold is trying to do, I mean, rally before it actually happens. So I think that if we get definitive indicators that point to a recession, for example, if we get a negative GDP, or we get negative non-farm payrolls, or the unemployment rate starts going up uncontrollably, actually this will probably go bad for all asset classes except bonds, of course. But until that happens, some asset classes like gold can actually rally in anticipation. Like investors are trying to get in front of what the Fed might do in response to a weaker environment. So this is how I see things.
Thank you, Marco. Does anyone have anything to add to gold before I move into a little bit of a more loaded topic as we await data?
I think something interesting about gold is that there's been this huge movement of physical gold out of London, out of Europe, and into New York. So one of the stories is that's fear of tariffs and so forth. I don't know if that makes sense. I'm not clear that gold would be tariffed, but you know, we also have a lot of geopolitical things brewing in the background. I noticed overnight when there was news of escalation in the Middle East, and gold is getting a bid, and we still have a lot of, I think, geopolitical uncertainty with the potential pullback of the U.S. Involvement in Europe and maybe ongoing war there as well. So maybe that might be getting a bid as people move money out of, let's say, potential war theaters into the U.S., which is separated by two beautiful oceans.
So Joseph lightly touched where I wanted to take us next. And I know on the last several panels, tariffs have been a hot topic, but they have remained a hot topic in general. So I would be remiss not to at least lightly touch it today. So there are those additional pressures of potential tariffs with more significant tariffs announced, retracted, re-announced, seemingly in a rinse and repeat pattern. Now, if the tariffs that are currently levied and additional tariffs that have been floated by the Trump admin come to fruition, what might we see as a result for the citizens within the United States? Bob, could you start us with this?
We're basically transitioning from a point where we had the lowest tariffs in decades in the post-war era, you know, pretty close to it, to if all the tariffs get announced, and remember the way at least it's being proposed right now, is that you're stacking geographic-oriented tariffs on top of product-specific tariffs. You add those things together, and you're talking about an overall U.S. tariff rate that's going to be above Smoot-Hawley. And from a U.S. consumer perspective, you know, you never know exactly how substitution is going to work and all that stuff, but it probably looks like a raise in prices of 1 to 1.5%. You know, being kind of conservative in the sense of expecting people to substitute, you know, pretty meaningfully to the extent that they can. You know, that's a pretty big, you know, that's meaningful in terms of the U.S. economy. The real question then becomes, what is the magnitude of the retaliatory tariffs? Because that will flow through to U.S. exporters, and that could easily, let's say you had a Canada-like tariff response, which is about a third the size of, at least what they proposed was about a third of the size of the U.S. tariffs on Canada, you know, then you're talking about probably another half to 1% of GDP. And now we've got a tariff war that's basically taken real GDP from, you know, running at about 2%, maybe a little less than that on an ongoing basis, basically into the negative. It'll take a little time and stuff like that for that actually to flow through. But look, if they implement the tariffs over a meaningful period of time that they've proposed so far, it's a big fucking deal, and it's going to drag the economy into the ground. That's all there is to it. And it's not priced in at all.
Does anyone have anything to add to Bob's take there? Any echoing or pushback?
Yeah, I think it's important to think about it both. You know, you have two kind of groups of people, one talking from like a purely like economic textbook perspective, and then you have people thinking more on like a strategic long-term national security perspective. And obviously, I think Trump sort of in his ideas is looking at it in from the latter view, where he's looking at, you know, manufacturing or sort of industrial capacity stalling out and being flat for the past 15 years as it continues to rapidly rise in places like China. And, you know, thinking that as a sort of an important thing that needs to get addressed from a national security perspective, longer term, whatever that means for the economy in the short term. And in his view, I think that he thinks, you know, especially as a second term president, that he's willing to make those decisions for the interest. So I don't, people obviously may agree or disagree with that. But the reality is, I think that, you know, to the extent that they're implemented in any way similar to what they're being proposed, it's a much bigger deal than it was in 2017. You know, when there was a China trade war, obviously a lot of those exports got rerouted through other places in Asia that would be harder if he's doing sort of blanket geographic tariffs this time around. Obviously the Canada and Mexico component is huge because those are two of the biggest trading partners and they're so intricately sort of involved in supply chain stuff, particularly with autos and that sort of thing. And so that's going to be a huge uncertainty. And obviously it's a tax, and it's a tax that at least in some part shows up in consumer prices. So not only is it a growth issue for the short term, it also adds, at least in the immediate effect, inflationary pressures. So I think it's a big deal.
Marco, do you have anything to add to that, perhaps from the perspective of the rest of the world outside of North America?
Okay, so I'm going to have to disagree about tariffs being inflationary. I actually think that tariffs will end up being deflationary in the end, because if they really go up by that much, like what Trump has been saying, and if we get a response from all of these countries, and they just start increasing their own tariffs, and then Trump responds, at some point it will be people will just say, okay, I paid, I don't know, an X amount for this, but because this is now, I don't know, 10, 20, 50% or whatever, more expensive than it was before the tariffs, I will be left with less money to spend on some other things. So actually, while some prices might rise, the other prices might not. Like consumers might push back on spending on some other goods, and then when you add all of that together, I don't know. In the end, it could be that if consumption actually contracts, there is really a possibility that we see a deflation in the end and not inflation. I'm not saying like this is not something that will happen in a month or two, because short term probably we will see prices spike up, but just because we have this one time or two time or whatever adjustment in prices, it doesn't automatically mean that the inflation will go up. Because for inflation to go up, actually consumers need to have a lot of liquidity to actually spend on all of these goods. And if they spend less, I mean they will spend more on goods that cost more, but then they will have less money to spend on some other goods. So actually, when we see the overall inflation, it may not move much, or it may actually go down if the overall consumption actually goes down, because, for example, tariffs can lead to a spike in the unemployment rate. If the unemployment goes up, actually people will have, of course, less income. There will be less income on the aggregate in the economy, and we could see consumption stalling or going negative. And if this happens, I don't see a plausible scenario where actually inflation could go up. At least not in a sustainable way. Like it can go up 1 month or 2 months because of course when tariffs are introduced, prices are actually passed on consumers pretty much instantly. But after that, I think we will actually settle for a lower inflation.
Oh, hey guys, I got to hop off real quick, but I'll just add that I agree with Marco that, you know, the last time we had this in 2018, we had, you know, some kind of an implosion in the markets and a big deflationary move, right? If you have fewer stock market goes down, you know, that impacts sentiment. So, you know, whatever tariffs you charge, it's going to be overwhelmed by disinflationary forces and economic downturn. So, yeah, I don't really worry about inflation if we really do have these big tariffs. But in any case, thanks so much for having me, guys. And 2 minutes away, I'll talk to you guys next time.
Sounds great, Joseph. And as always, thanks for coming, man. Your guy is very invaluable to these panels. So I do have a pretty loaded follow-up for that topic, but we've only got about 2 minutes before we get some data for you guys to comb through. So for now, with these 2 minutes, does anyone have anything else to add to Marco and Joseph points there?
I would just add that I describe the tariffs as a cost, and I think I mostly agree with what was said by both of them around the aggregate spending, because of course aggregate spending is really determined by aggregate wages and income. And if that aggregate wage and income growth doesn't occur or isn't supported by government transfers, then you're likely not going to get aggregate spending rise. And so the most likely impact, what I'd say is, while the inflationary pressure and exactly how it gets measured is ambiguous to say, what is clear is it's negative for real GDP. And that is, and what stocks care about is, you know, a negative real GDP will have an influence on stocks, it'll have an influence on the labor market and on sentiment. And so I think that, in some ways, we could all get twisted up in a knot trying to argue exactly how the prices are going to flow through and et cetera, how to get measured and all that stuff. And the big picture thing is it's a big cost, which will drive down real GDP at the economy-wide level, both for the U.S. and globally for trade partners. And that's largely not priced into stocks at all, with stocks just offline.
There's a slowdown to QT beginning in April, which was somewhat expected or at least considered at this meeting. Tim Rose put out a piece this morning that sort of gave the preview that might be coming, or further confirming that. So that has come through. That's probably the biggest tangible change.
I think that nothing much has changed here. They still expect two rate cuts in 2025. Rates were left unchanged, of course, like it was widely expected. And for this slowdown of QT, I haven't seen the information yet. So actually, I'm still looking at the information. But if it's about the May meeting that they will actually slow the QT or possibly end it, then this could possibly be interpreted as dovish to some point. But just because there were the Fed didn't add any rates, I think that something that the market was hoping for, which is the so-called Fed put, I don't think that it's actually coming this time around. Maybe some people can hope that it may come in the future, but for now we don't see it. At least not from what I've seen in this initial reports. But I'm still going through it.
So just to quickly add on the QT side, they're reducing the treasury. So there's two components of QT, mortgages and treasuries. The treasury component is basically going to almost zero. It's going from $25 billion a month down to $5 billion. So maybe that's a compromise to say that they haven't paused it. Actually, it's still going, but it's going at a much, much slower pace than it would otherwise. They haven't made a change to the mortgage allocation, which is interesting. So that continues on as it is, but it's important to note that those the repayments of mortgages actually happen much slower than the treasuries, and so they don't actually hit that cap in most periods. So the impact there, the total QT is going to be down probably, I don't know, 20, 30 billion a month. So it's an interesting mix of the treasury versus mortgage decision on that. I'm sure people will read more into that, but that's just an initial reaction.
Thank you both. If anything else jumps out to you, feel free to tackle it. I think we are trying to get Bob back up here as well. He got the same Twitter treatment that I did. But in the meantime, I mentioned I had a follow-up to the potential stressors that might be felt by citizens amidst this potential trade war that's ongoing. Many Americans are already feeling some financial stress, especially with the costs of goods and rent exceeding wage increases. In terms of consumer staples, or rather consumer discretionary sector of the markets, last bear, you had written that early March showed signs of reversal. However, since early March, even Walmart's CEO has said that it's very evident that consumers are protecting their money, buying less, and ultimately viewing the current economic climate as tenuous at best. Early this month, you kind of touched on this via the consumer ETF, ticker XLP. How do you feel now on consumer staples last spare? Will consumer spending remain suppressed or perhaps drop even more?
Yeah, I think you've seen a number of warnings like the one you mentioned. Obviously, there was the airline warning that came out a couple weeks ago that got a lot of press. People have talked about food and beverage retail sales going down, maybe that being an indicating of sort of discretionary spending. I think what you're the tweet that you're referring to, I was talking about sort of the difference between consumer discretionary and consumer staples. So obviously, both of those are consumer-driven categories, but the idea being that discretionary purchases obviously are more sensitive, could be more sensitive to economic conditions. They're generally larger, more durable goods type things that you might choose to forego as opposed to buying toothpaste or something like that. I do think that it's interesting. You've seen the reversal in discretionary versus staples really start to come back over the past month or so, with staples outperforming discretionary, kind of as these fears have come back into the market. If you look at a longer term chart, I think that there's definitely evidence that that could continue, especially given just sort of the trading discrepancy or multiple discrepancy between higher value discretionary stocks and at least certain staples. I would just note, if we're talking about consumer staples, we talked about, or I mentioned the ETF that sort of covers the S&P sector. But I would also encourage folks to look into that and be selective in that bucket. I think that there's certain stocks, particularly at the top of the list, like Costco and Walmart, for example, that have really gotten bid up over the past year, are trading at really historically high multiples for those sort of businesses. Whereas a lot of the other sort of more traditional consumer staples that are in that bucket maybe are a better defensive play at this point.
Fair enough. Thank you, Last Bear. And kind of on that topic of Costco, I thought it was pretty interesting to see that news about the wage increase with a promise of the next few years receiving wage increases as well, but at the same time, pretty aggressively suppressing unionization attempts. So I just thought that that was pretty interesting on that front. But kind of more on this wages topic, especially in contrast with earnings, we've still seen pretty strong earnings, but with some signs of slowing down. And some analysts argue that high corporate profit margins are actually contributing to inflation more than wage growth is, which takes us back to, costs definitely outpacing wages. Now, do you believe there's strict evidence for this? And if so, how should the Fed respond to that? Marco, could you start us off?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question. I was doing something.
No yeah. worries. So we...
Yeah.
Oh, Last Bear, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just on the point about corporate profits. I think it's probably, first, just a level set. Like, it is true that corporate profits corporate margins have increased substantially over the past 25 years or so. I think they're about 5 or 6%, maybe at the turn of the century. Now they're in between 11 and 12% right now. So if you think about earnings growth in the S&P 500, more than half of that over the past 25 years has come from margin expansion as opposed to top line growth. And there's multiple reasons for that. I think one, the Fed actually went and did a survey or some sort of analysis that showed part of that was corporate interest expense going down. Part of that was tax policy. So there's policy levers at play. And then there's probably also some sort of level of monopolistic type or other sort of market structures that are adding to that. But that's been a big factor at macroeconomically. If you think about how the stock market overall and corporate equities fits into the broader bucket of economic wealth of the country, obviously that's more concentrated amongst higher earnings and higher wealth individuals. And you could argue that it's less about it's more about a segregation, or how do you split up wealth in between profits versus, let's say, if it was higher employment costs that would reduce profits, but maybe help out a broader section of the population. And I think that there is probably some sort of element of argument that's relevant here, just around populism, the rise of discontent that sort of happened, especially over the past 15 years, starting back from Occupy Wall Street and going through all the other the election of Trump the first time and just continuing on, where we have a really buoyant and really great stock market, allegedly, or actually, but You know, but there's a huge amount of discontent with people feeling that they're not participating in the economy, that they are not benefiting from it. And so I think that, you know, the issue of corporate margins probably ties into that in some way. I don't think it's, you know, a direct one-to-one, but it is something that sort of ties into this broader shift where people in the markets or people in certain levels of society are thinking that things are quite great and don't understand how other people are dissatisfied. But the reality is that a lot of people are dissatisfied. And some of the changes that Trump is suggesting with respect to national security and trade and tariff, whether those ultimately prove to be beneficial in the long term, I think they're largely driven from, you know, deeper sort of socioeconomics dissatisfaction in how sort of things have aligned and sort of the current world order. So it's all related, but it's definitely an interesting topic.
For sure. And kind of on that note, you had mentioned the higher wealth individuals. I think it was Moody's Analytics that said, I think nearly half of all U.S. spending was occurring by just the top 10% of earners, which is a really interesting metric to have as well as we talk about this with wages. So kind of as a tag onto that, as far as the GDP goes again, sorry to kick us back here, consumer spending remained a pretty key driver of that in quarter four of last year. But with these recent signs of slowdown, should we at all be concerned about a pullback in consumer activity as a whole, or is this just a sort of normalization phase of sorts? Marco, could you touch that one?
Yeah. Actually, it all depends what happens in March, as I said, because in January and February, we actually had flattish activity by consumers. If we see the same in March, then maybe we could start actually be a bit more worried, because it will when we have this flattish activity, we actually don't know. It's probably just a matter of time before it actually goes the other way, and if it starts rolling over, then it's a problem. But there is the other possibility, of course, if March turns out to be better than expected. So I don't know, maybe we see some more meaningful rise in that month. Then consumption could remain more or less okay. For example, if we get something like closer to 1 percentage point of personal consumption contributing to the GDP, that would be okay-ish. Like maybe we can expect it to continue in the following months, and maybe it doesn't roll over like it could happen if it comes flattish. And of course, if it comes negative in March, then it would roll over already in Q1, and probably Q2 will just fall. So this is something that we actually need to watch. Things are really uncertain at this point, because things can go both ways. Certainly in the past, when we worried about the consumption, actually it turned out that we shouldn't worry about it, because it didn't turn out as bad as the worries were. So I don't know. This time around, it seems like it could be different, but it's always like we really need to watch the data, and we need to understand that there's a huge possibility for us to see revisions, and these revisions may not come for some quarters. For example, in the second quarter of 2022. Everyone thought that the GDP was down, And this was the reason why when consumers actually pulled back and the consumer sentiment actually fell. But as it turned out, we only learned that in the third quarter of 2024. The second quarter of 2022 wasn't actually negative in the end. It's now it is reported as a positive number. So it can really take a while before we understand what is actually going on. So I think it's a bit prudent to it's more prudent to be mindful of both scenarios. Like things could deteriorate from here. Things could go the other way. We just need to wait and watch for.
Thank you, Marco. So kind of spinning off of that, since we've got about 14 minutes before Jerome Powell hits the podium, UBS Global Wealth Management suggests a 20% risk of, quote, stagflation, but does not predict a recession yet. So last bear, if you could, what exactly is stagflation and what, if any, is the delineation between that scenario and a recession?
Yeah, I guess I haven't seen that report. I don't really understand what they mean by that. I don't think that there's signs, at least right now, that we're heading into a stagflationary environment. We just don't see, even if we see inflation sort of slowing towards the 2% goal and maybe sort of staying at a place where it's elevated above what that goal is, we don't really see a huge impulse higher at this point. I think if you look at certain goods, maybe you can make the case, but broadly speaking, a whole wide range of inflation data doesn't really show that really inflecting upwards at this point. And I do think that there were really unique circumstances around the spike in inflation and COVID, both just the extreme level of stimulus across the board, particularly in the U.S., combined with obviously things like oil production, natural gas production dropping tremendously and supply chain issues and all the rest. I don't think that we're going to be in a position where we see a spike in inflation that even if it does go up, that's going to look like what we saw most recently. But I don't understand the argument that the EBS is making there, that they see no recession and sort of, I guess that sounds like sort of a low growth, higher inflation, higher rates type scenario, which I think actually is not impossible. I think the term stagflation is just super loaded these days. And it's one that I try to avoid unless we see more sort of concrete evidence that that's the case, which we haven't seen at this point.
Fair enough. Thank you, Last Bear. Marco, did you have anything to add to Last Bear's points there on the topic of stagflation?
I actually agree with everything that he said. Stagflation, I don't know. The term originated in the 1970s when inflation was much, much higher than it is currently. And it was driven by some other factors that are not present today, among which the unusual rise in the population at the time. Baby boomers were they were getting their first paychecks, and they got into the labor force for the first time. And then after that, of course, when they got first paychecks, they started spending money. And of course, things went wild. And on the other hand, the Fed during the 1970s, it was really like they had this expansionary policy. The liquidity they injected during the 1970s is nowhere near what they actually did in 2020 and 2022, let alone what they did after that. I mean, not in aggregate numbers, of course, but in relative numbers, because they were really pumping the liquidity for like 15 years, and this was really something that was constant during the 1970s. We don't have anything like that today, so I know that stagflation is really like something that people like to talk about because it is popular, of course, but I don't think that we have anything like that today, and that we can actually replicate anything in the economy that is currently in place to what actually happened during the 1970s. These are like completely different things, and I think that if we see a slowdown, it will probably be more of the usual nature. Like we'll probably see it in a form that the activity goes down along with inflation. So actually, if that happens, probably deflation risks will actually rise. I mean, the market is obviously not pricing this at this moment, and I don't know when the market might start pricing that. But I think these are actually the risks that we should probably need to worry if the slowdown actually materializes in a way that some people are fearing. Because if the unemployment rate starts going up uncontrollably, it will be tough to have that and the current inflation. I mean, inflation would probably need to go down, and at that point we just actually we cannot know whether inflation will actually undershoot and go, I don't know, to zero or possibly below that. This is, of course, this can be exacerbated if, for example, something breaks in a, I don't know, in a similar manner as it did during the great financial crisis. But now we are starting to speculate on what might happen and what might not. So I think it's better to wait for the data and see how the economy is actually evolving.
And maybe if I could just add on and contradict myself and my prior response, I do think that in the short term that there's the points that Mark was laying out about sort of what happens if there's a recession, that it's likely to lower prices. I think those are all good points. I do think that there's like a million-dollar question, probably maybe the most important question in markets over like the next 10 years is sort of a bigger question long-term about like what are we on a structural increase in rates and inflation, or whether this was just a temporary blip. And that question, I think, is still like very much open, and people have different opinions on it. I think if you look at the Fed's perspective of where the long-term neutral rate or the R-star rate is going, that has increased. I think that we also have become, after 40 years of constantly declining rates, basically from late or early 1980s till 2020, there's an expectation that's kind of been built in that rates just are permanently low. But if you look throughout history, what you see is that there are sort of these big super cycles of rates that sort of go down and then come back up. The current treasury curve is entirely above 4%. It's been that way for some time. And there's a question for markets, which is, it may be that stagflationary environment that UBS is sort of referring to, or maybe more accurately, sort of a low growth, higher rate environment. Whether that means that rates could actually potentially go higher than they are right now, at least on the long end, where the term premium is basically nothing or negative. And so I think that's a much bigger long-term question, and it might get resolved, or sort of in the short term, economic conditions will likely take precedent over those sort of longer term structural things. But it's just something that I think investors for the long term need to at least have on the radar.
And kind of on that note, I know we only got about 5 minutes here and kicking myself a little bit for not bringing it up. But on that topic of treasuries, the yield curve remains inverted, with the 2-year treasuries yielding more than the 10 over I think, for over 18 months now. And kind of given past recession signals, do you think this inversion still holds predictive power here in 2025? Either of you feel free to touch that.
Yeah, I think that the curve on the 2-year has inverted at this point. I think the 2 is at 4.1 and the, you know, 10 years, 4.3. So it's slight. So it has reverted basically in the past month or two, I believe. The 10 minus 3 month rate, which is another spread that people look at, I think is just slightly inverted at this point. It's basically flat. So again, you know, when we had inversion happen, that kind of spawns a lot of discussion around, oh, the yield curve's inverted. That means a recession's coming. But really, it's after the reversion happens that the recession comes. So if you go back and, you know, look at least through the past 40 years or so, that has been a reliable indicator. And it's one of those things where I think people have, you know, because people have been talking about yield curve inversion for 2 years, and we've had a relatively stable economy and generally good economy through that period, you know, people maybe have forgotten about really how that works and are maybe ignoring that signal as it's now sort of coming back to a reversion.
Marco, did you have anything to add there while we wait to push into the presser here?
I actually think that the Les Bear is right about that. The yield curve inversion is actually probably telling us something, and that is that the recession will come, but it doesn't tell us when. So it could happen right now, it could happen in 6 months, it could happen in a year. We just don't know that. So actually, it's more like, okay, we know in which way the economy is going, but we don't know the exact timing of that. If we're looking at the yield curve inversion, I actually think that going forward, like 10 years from now, who knows what will happen? Of course, it's possible that the rates will be higher than they are right now, but I think before they go higher, they're probably going to go lower, because during every recession, the Fed is more likely to cut rates than not. So this is something that will probably unfold at some point. The trick is, of course, to know when will that happen, because all of these indicators will not tell us the exact moment when this will happen. But they actually provide us with a good signal about the economic slowdown coming, but we just don't know when.
Pretty fair points, I would say. Thank you, Marco. We have about a minute and some change until Jay Powell's presser. Les Bear, if there's anything you wanted to add here at the tail end before we flip over to Jerome, feel free.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I think it was a point earlier, you were mentioning sort of top percent earners making a large percentage of consumer spending. I would just add that, you know, the wealth effect there with respect to the stock market, I think is significant. If you look at equity as a percentage of total financial assets, it has never been higher in the U.S. So the U.S. economy has arguably never been more levered, at least, you know, personal net wealth has never been more levered to the stock market than it is right now. And obviously that's concentrated amongst the cohorts that have been sort of the powerful spending force. So that's just another point to add on to some of the earlier discussion. But outside of that, obviously always appreciate you guys having me on this panel. You guys can check out my Substack. There's some changes coming to that I think are really exciting. You'll see those when they come out.